Hi there, my name's Mike Bach. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Lloyd, for asking me to talk again. Lloyd's asked me to talk quite a few times since I've known him, and it's always an honor to speak here and in front of this group. Jerry, thanks for an awesome message. I would have been fine if you just took the rest of the hour. Instead of that, you're going to have to put up with this crap. I got sober on June 3rd of 2003, and like Jerry, that date is important to me. I'm convinced that, pretty much any other date in my life, I would, forget. Even my birthday, if I didn't have to put it down on job applications or stuff like that, I'm pretty good about my wedding anniversary. But most other dates I don't remember, but that one, I haven't forgotten it. I've never had to even really search my memory for it. It's right there. And I think there's something to that. And what it means to me is that there truly is nothing more important than my sobriety. That's one expression of that. I am sponsored, and I have the privilege of sponsoring some guys now. And as I always like to say, the grateful ones are here tonight to support me. There was never a time in my, from the first time I drank, people had a problem with it. There was never a time in my life when people were okay with my drinking, even when it was legal for me to drink. Like, I got drunk for the first time when I was 16, and so that was illegal, and your parents didn't want you to do that, and so they had a problem with it. But when I'm 25 and your parents still have a problem with you drinking, or when you're 30 and your parents still have a problem with you drinking, and everybody else does too, it tells you something that you don't want to hear, right? And it was problematic for everybody, and I probably should have been kicked out of every institution I ever attended. I probably, should have been arrested a lot more times than I actually was because of my drinking. And I was one of those guys, I used to say I never got away with anything, but that's not really true because I'm standing here alive. And I probably shouldn't be, but I was also the kind of guy who, I would walk out of a bar and, the police would never say, okay, just move along and be quiet. I mean, my hands were always on the hood. That always happened to me, but I never caught any serious time. I caught some very lucky breaks and all that kind of stuff. But I knew from early on that this was an issue. And I think a lot of my time and energy, that I put into my relationships with other people in my life was basically defending my drinking, because that was always the subject. You're drunk again. You didn't come home again. You got another letter from college. All this kind of stuff. What's that all about? And so you got a drunk driving and all that kind of stuff. And I said, I just got unlucky. I mean, it's Wisconsin, Mom. It's Milwaukee. Everybody drives drunk. Dad drove drunk. We all drive drunk. Come on. I just got caught. Not realizing how insane that sounded to normal people. But I spent a lot of time defending my drinking when I should have been building relationships and taking an interest in other people and all that kind of stuff. Instead, my relationships were about defending my drinking. And, my first sponsor always used to say that, you got between me and my drinking, and you made me make a choice. I was always going to choose the drinking. I may not say that out loud, but my actions would say that. You know what I mean? And nothing that was told to me in AA when I got here about my drinking or about what kind of person I was news to me. People have been calling me selfish and alcoholic and self-centered and dishonest and resentful pretty much my entire life. I'm dirtbag, So from the time I picked up, there has to be a reason why you keep on drinking when you're getting all this feedback that says, stop doing that. You're disgusting. You're pathetic. We don't know how to deal with you anymore. And the reason is because I'm an alcoholic. And what that has come to mean to me is that there are no circumstances under which I won't drink. Except one. I'm going to talk about that later. But all the other ones, You know, I will never suffer too much. I will never go through too many consequences. There is no admonition that's going to, like, you know, have any impact on me. It's like what does the book say? Frothy emotional peel seldom suffices. None of that stuff ever even gave me a moment's pause. I knew what to say to people who talked to me like that. Like, I was so damn manipulative, you know, and I would say, you know, I'd hang my head in shame and say, "You're right." And, like, I'm not ashamed at all during this. I'm just like, I just know the drill. And for some reason, I think the family bought into the BS for a while until they stopped. And a lot of people who bought into the BS probably are sick too. And the people who didn't, they were never a part of my life anymore. They just left. You know what I mean? Like, it's funny because apparently, I was told this, you know, a while ago, I was like an awesome first date. Because I wouldn't drink, like, I was a great first date, but I was a terrible third date. Because I couldn't stop drinking that, you know, I just couldn't keep it together that long. And if I was a terrible third date, you know, there were people after that third date who stayed with me for a while. You know what I mean? Like, but the well-adjusted ones that had their stuff together and all that kind of stuff, I mean, I never heard from them again. They were like, "Lose my phone number," like, you know. So anyway, I picked up my first drink at 16, and, you know, like a lot of alcoholics, I strongly felt like I sucked in every aspect of life. Like, I looked around and I compared myself to my friends and my peers and my cousins and the people I grew up with, and I'm like, they have something I don't. That makes life, like, they have, like, this mastery over life, that they're not scared of interpersonal interactions or anything like that. They're not scared of school. They're not scared of people. They're not scared of anything. They don't have really, I mean, they have, and they're able to do stuff that seemed to me like almost impossible. And I was scared of people, and I was also resentful of them because, I mean, almost automatically, I hated all other people because it seemed like they had something I didn't that made living life easier, right? And, I would talk sometimes with hubris and bluster, and I'd get, like, I'd be this arrogant little twerp, but, you know, deep down inside, I felt stupid and, not worth the skin I was cloaked in, and you know, a disappointment to my family and all this kind of stuff, and no one really put that on me. And I remember I tell the story a lot. I stole a pack of gum when I was 9 years old from a drugstore. It was the first time I ever stole something, and as I was doing it, it felt awesome. It was the pack of gum at that time was 10 cents, and as soon as I left, I started walking down the street with it, and I started looking at my hand. I didn't want to open it and take a stick out. And I felt like I was going to go to hell for stealing a pack of gum. And I grew up Catholic, and I'm not putting that on, like, the nuns or anything like that, or my folks who brought me up in that tradition. But that stuck with me. For a long time. I mean, you know, I could not shake that one. And I think at some point, even before I drank, I adopted the idea, well, I'm going to hell anyway. This is what it says. This is what everybody says. And, you know, so what's the point of living correctly? What's the point of morality? What's the point of anything? I better look out for myself until life isn't worth living anymore. So I came into my first drink, like, feeling like just the biggest piece of crap to ever set foot on earth. And as soon as I got drunk, I didn't feel that way anymore. As a matter of fact, I felt like the best thing to ever cast a shadow upon the earth before me. And there's nothing that even came close to producing that kind of effect in my life. It didn't matter. Not winning a race or winning a football game, nothing like not getting an A+. That did absolutely positively nothing for me. But But getting drunk, that did everything for me that I wanted to happen. Like, I mean, I could, if I had made out a list of things I want to feel differently about, I mean, booze would have covered it. And so, you know, and I got really drunk the first time I drank, and I threw up all over the place, and I apparently it was very loud because it woke my parents up, and you know, I'm in my brother and I's bathroom, and I'm selling the Buick all over the place, and my mom walks in, and I remember it was the first time I ever proffered a pledge that I would never do this again. But at that time, I totally didn't mean it. I knew, even as I'm like totally like doing major core work, as I'm barfing my guts out, I knew at that time that I was going to do this again. And for a while after that, I mean, I didn't drink every day, but it's all I thought about. It's all I cared about. Nothing else mattered to me anymore. I mean, I'd do other stuff so I could do that. You know what I mean? And I also knew I probably shouldn't speak out loud about what my life goal is to anybody. But my life goal was to drink as much as possible because that made me feel great. And I just loved it. I mean, and, you know, I was pretty good through high school, I guess. And I mean, I would get in trouble a few more times. But when I went to college, I got, you know, it was funny. For a while, I think I held on the idea that I might make something out of myself, and you know, so I tried to do well in school, and I was in. I got recruited to school for athletics, if you can believe that shit, you know, and I was pretty good during training and all that kind of stuff, but you know, and at the end of my college career, I was running cross country. And I blew my knee up in the last race of the season. And, I mean, I had to get a thigh high and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it was, you know, I was in a lot of pain. And this is before, like, Oxy and all that crap. And, you know, and so they didn't give you anything. They just said, you know, here's a Tylenol. You know, my knee was literally, like, popped out of joint. And there was a party across campus. You know, for like, because all the sports seasons had pretty much ended, and everybody came back from wherever they were, and I was in this thigh high with these crutches, and I'm like, oh no, I'm going to this party, man. I've been waiting all season for this stuff, and I got absolutely shit faced, and I left my crutches at the party, and I came home in a blackout with my thigh high like totally wrapped around my leg wrong. I had no idea what happened. Other than when I woke up, I screamed so loud that they called security. I said, what the hell happened? And they came in and saw like this cast and stuff all covered. The point being is that I didn't care about anything up to that night where I got to drink. And, you know, I kind of went through college. You know, I finished college, and I talk about this too. The day I graduated, the week before, you have a week up from your last exam to when you graduate, and that whole week, I was just a garbage disposal. I mean, drinking and hallucinogenics and pot and some powdered stuff that I didn't really, I didn't know what most of the stuff was that I was taking. You ever have that experience, you know, when you're at a big party like that, or somebody hands you something, you pop it in your mouth, and you say, hey, what was that, you know, I had a lot of that week, and I was just a mess. And my parents, to this day, I mean, they cited it as one of the worst days in their lives, the day I graduated college, is to see me like that. It was just a huge disappointment. But I was unfazed, I guess, and I went to Washington, D.C. for a while, and one thing led to another, and I got into the beer business because I couldn't do anything else. Like, I went there for, like, a job that I totally didn't deserve, but it didn't work out, and I just ended up where I thought I belonged, driving a beer truck in Washington, D.C. It was actually, to this day, this is my favorite job ever. I love that job. And I did well at it, you know, because I had a great enthusiasm about the product. And I loved it because, you know, it was pretty good hours, and I ate for free at pretty much every bar in Washington, D.C., and this is all during the 90s, you know, and I just had a blast. And things weren't, you know, I had girlfriends and stuff at the time, but I mean, I didn't really care about them. And, I didn't. I treated them like crap. It was more like I wanted some semblance of stability, you know, and I think that's kind of like my, it's kind of like saying, like, I know I'm not living normal, but maybe if I give the appearance, but I didn't really very much care for the women that were dumb enough to date me back then. And my progression was pretty quick, and I gave up a lot of things. I got a lot of opportunities because of where I went to school and people my parents knew and all this kind of stuff. I was given a lot of chances to do some really pretty cool stuff, and all of them I just drank away. You know what I mean? And I, like I said, I ended up being a fairly large disappointment to just about everybody in my life. And eventually, right around 9/11, I had to come back home and live with mommy and daddy. And at that time, I was 31 years old, and shortly thereafter, I got diagnosed with throat cancer. And the ENT who diagnosed me said, the cancer you have is consistent with alcoholism. How much do you drink? And right then, I've got a cancer diagnosis. And this is before this was really, like, super treatable. And I lied to him. And I said, I have a couple beers after work. I've never had a couple beers ever. That has never been a part of my experience. Even when I'm trying to not drink, it's never just a couple beers. You know what I mean? I eventually came clean with that guy, but it was after he showed me, you know, what can happen. And they show you those pictures that work on seventh graders. You know, like if you smoke, they show you the picture of the lung, and he showed me a picture of like what the esophageal surgery looks like, and it's not pretty. And I dodged that bullet, and you would think that a life event like that would give someone pause about how they're living their lives, and maybe they should do something. And it did not. As soon as I cycled out of chemo, I started drinking again. Not very long, but like I kept on drinking, and I drank. I'm sorry. I spoke as if, like, I didn't drink during chemo. I totally drank during chemo. And if you drink during chemo, you're an alcoholic. We're not supposed to diagnose you, but I'm totally doing that right now. I couldn't get up a set of stairs, and, like, I was having toxic reactions to everything I was trying to put down my mouth. But anyway, I started drinking again after. And then this one, it was the day after, or my birthday weekend, I went on a bender, and for some reason that Monday, there's nothing special about this. There's nothing crazy, or, you know, there's no big event. It was literally a normal weekend. It was a normal day for me at that time. But I just decided I can't live like this anymore. I'd been to AA before. I went to AA in Washington, D.C., and I mean, Jerry might know this, but the Improv in Connecticut used to have lunchtime meetings. And at the time, I was working for a beer company. And so I'd say, oh, how convenient, a noontime meeting right in the middle of my route. So I'd pull up to an AA meeting in a beer truck. All these newcomers outside, and everybody looked at me like I had a hole in my head. You know, what are you doing? You know, and you got to quit that job, man. And I told myself, oh, no, I can do the job and you know, not drink. And they're like, no, you can't. And they were right. But it was, I guess I wasn't ready. Certainly wasn't willing at that point to do whatever it took to get sober. But I, that time after the chemo and all that stuff, I called the AA Pull-Up Bureau in Milwaukee, and I said, you know, I need to get to a meeting. And they asked me where I lived, and they sent me to this place around the corner. And I don't remember what happened there. And I didn't really want to be there, but I knew I had to stop drinking, you know. One of the things it means, when you show up at AA, whether you realize this or not, one of the things it means is that you're out of options. You may think you have options, but if you're sitting here, you don't. You don't. You have no options. And some people going on trying, you know, leave and try to find other options, but there are no options. And part of me just kind of knew that, like, there's nowhere else for me to go but here. No one else wanted me around anymore. You know, everybody was sick and disgusted with me. It wasn't that my drinking was so revolting. I mean, it was, but, like, not to me. It was revolting to everybody else. But what was hitting me here was just the looks I got from just about everybody in my life. And the best it ever got was pity. But most of the time it was disgust. Like, and look at what you've turned into. You know what I mean? And, you know, so I went to these meetings and, you know, I was unmoved by what I had seen. But I knew I had nowhere else to go. So I kept on going to these meetings kind of aimlessly. And people there talked about sponsorship and people were really nice and all that kind of stuff. I would come to find out later that this club I was going to probably was not exactly on the beam when it came to AA. Like they, you know, it was kind of more like a, I don't know, I'm not going to characterize it. I got sober there and anyway, I talked to my pigeons a lot about going to meetings that you may not care for too much. Because if your message is so, you know, hot, if you got an awesome message, then maybe you need to go where it's not being spoken. You know what I mean? And that's where my first sponsor went to the place I was going. You know, because he thought he had something. And he did. He caught me about a week after I got to AA. I was just going to meetings every day as often as I could and talking about how I felt. You know, and complaining about my family, all this kind of stuff. You know, the stuff that somebody who doesn't know what they're doing in AA does. I mean, my sponsor zeroed in on that. What got me was really kind of funny. Where I got sober in Milwaukee, at the end of the meeting, after you say the Our Father, it's huggy time. Everybody hugs everybody. It's not like you hug the people you know or, you know, anything like that. You don't shake hands. It's huggy time. And I found this, in most cases, fairly revolting. Sometimes it was nice, but most of the time, not so much. And he stuck his hand out when I went to hug him, you know, because I had been, you know, indoctrinated into huggy time. And he said, I want to talk to you outside. And I saw who I was going to have to hug next. And I said, absolutely, let's go. He did what the book describes, you know, which is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. He told me his story. This guy was my age, so he's 32 when he got sober. He was 9.5 years sober at that point. He spoke with a sincerity that I had not seen up to that point, or at least I hadn't been listening for. After he told me his story, he asked me some questions. Are you an alcoholic? Yes. Do you want to stop drinking? Yes, I really need to stop drinking. Are you willing to go to any length to do so? And I don't know why, but I just said yes. Because when you say any length to an alcoholic, that's an extreme. Alcoholics are usually comfortable with extremes, but like, not that one. But when I saw how he was talking to me and what he was doing there, which is being serious about alcoholism, serious about sobriety, he said something that really, I guess, hit me right here. You know, when he said, are you willing to go to any length to get sober, I kind of had this sense that he wasn't going to be telling me to, like, you know, wear a clown suit to AA meetings or do, you know, that, all that silly things that, you know, newcomers say, like, what are you going to make me do, you know, walk naked down the street, you know, all this kind of stuff. I believed he wasn't going to say that or do that, that his whole purpose, he was so serious about what he said and what he did, that his purpose, it seemed to me like his mission in life at that point was to get me sober. So I said, okay. You know, I said, what do I do? So I met him for a meeting every day. Sometimes I could meet him, and other times he would pick me up. What that started was a ride that my first year was, I used to say it was a really rough year. It wasn't. It was all over the place. It was an adventure. It was just, you know, some of the most greatest things I ever experienced and some of the toughest things I've ever gone through happened in that year. So I can't think of an adjective for that. So, you know, just put in your own. But it's when I went through the steps, or at least most of them. I remember He would pick me up and we'd go down to the east side. I lived with my parents because I was a winner in the suburbs, and we'd go down to the east side of Milwaukee to this Alamo Club they had down there for meetings quite often. It was about a 25-minute ride. And initially I would start, like, as soon as I got in the car, and I have a pigeon who does this now and it drives me nuts, and he's not taking to my correction very well, but, like, without even saying, "Hey, how you doing? What's going on, Heath?" or anything like that, I just sit down and start rattling off my problems. You know what I mean? And so he would, you know, turn the radio up in the car. So I got down there, and then he told me to shut up, and he said, "You can talk to me about it after the meeting, but right now I want you to get in the mindset of trying to help another drunk." And I'm like, trying to help another drunk? I need help. I'm here for help, not to give help, blah, 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 rick, tick, tick. And he would just shake his head and roll his eyes and just be like, you know, never gave up on me, though. I don't know if I had the best attitude when I got here. Not too many people do, but, like, he never gave up on me. And I'm, wow, standing here because of that. So anyway, we'd get there, and then at this one meeting we're at, somebody, like, I don't know, I'm like 10 days sober, and somebody picks up a white chip. And I want to run up to him after the meeting because he said we were going to talk about my problems after the meeting. And I was going up to him, and he looks at me, and he goes like that and points at the newcomer and said, "Go talk to him." And I tried to object, and he just, you know, kind of shooed me away. And so I went up to this guy who was, you know, actually was in much better shape than I was. And I said, "Hey, my name's Mike. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I see you picked up your white chip. How's it going so far? I'm 10 days sober. I hate myself. How are you?" And, like, but the thing is, I'll never forget the guy's name, and I'm pretty sure he didn't stick around, but we ended up talking for about a half an hour after that meeting. And I don't honestly know what he said. I think we were just talking, you know, newcomer stuff. I mean, we were talking about AA. It wasn't like we were talking about the Packers or anything like that, but, like, but I remember something, you know, when I finally got in the car with Heath, you know, he said, "Okay, I guess I'll listen to whatever problem you think you have now." And I think I said, it's not a big deal. I never said that about my problems ever in my life. Never once. Never once. My problems were always a big fucking deal. And if you didn't appreciate that they were a big deal, then you and I need to have a clarification. And that's the first time I ever said that. I think what I found is when you come to AA, your world consists of you and your problems. There's actually no other people in your world. They come in and out as either a cause of or solution to said problems. And when you try and help somebody else, the world gets a bit bigger. Now there's this other guy that you're trying to get sober, you know? And I think when your world gets bigger, your problems get a little bit smaller. And because I had no perspective on what my problems, I mean, to me, you know, a death in the family and a broken shoelace occupied the same emotional space. And when I felt that, and then I talked to a guy again, and then, you know, talked to another guy, and talked to another guy, and finally was able to take somebody to a meeting, and finally somebody's dumb enough to ask me to sponsor him and all that kind of stuff, and I was taking this guy through the drill and doing all that stuff. Like, these huge, ginormous problems that I thought were going to eat my lunch from the inside out weren't really problems anymore. It just weren't. God had just kind of said, "Okay, now you're helping other people, I'll help you," kind of thing. I'm not sure if that's how he operates. That's just kind of the way I felt at the time. And there was a great relief in that. You know, and this is before I'd even worked, like, a real step. You know, this is all in my first days and weeks of getting sober. And I began to get the idea that there was an answer for me here. I believed I was beyond redemption when I got to AA, and that I was beyond help. So for me to believe in, you know, in a few short months that, hey, this might work out, this might do the deal, that's a big deal. I think alcoholics, you know, expect everything to be repaired in short order. That's not my experience. But big things do happen in your first months here. I just don't think I was wired to appreciate that kind of thing. You know, I wasn't wired to appreciate, like, relief or a better sense of humanity or anything like that. But they're big things, and they mean something. Anyway, I'm going to go with this. We've been talking in the meetings I've been at recently. They've been talking a lot about, in the meeting I said last night at my home group, there, you know, it's about your commitment to AA. You know, what place it holds in your life and all that kind of stuff. And you know, every sponsor I've ever had, in one way or another, basically says, you know, you demonstrate what's important to you by what you do, not by what you say. If you don't do it, it's not important to you. You know what I mean? And so I can say AA is the most important thing in my life, but if I'm not going to meetings, if I'm not helping new guys, if I'm not praying and meditating, if I'm not seeking God, if I'm not doing all that stuff that I was taught to do from day one, then it's really not that important. I'm just saying it is. And, you know, I sponsor guys, you know, kind of a whole range of sobriety. And I think that what I found is that, you know, my sponsor today always tells us guys, you know, there's two types of people in AA. There's givers and there's takers. And he asks, which one do you want to be? Which one are you? And rather than call myself one or the other, what I've found, you know, just basically in my experience in sponsoring guys and watching guys in meetings and all that kind of thing, is that if you're a taker here, this is what happens. You come to AA, you get sober, you get a fellowship, and then maybe even not that slowly start to get things back. Things start to come into your life that can and should mean something to you. Like you get married, or you have children, or you get that great job, or whatever it may be. But the fatal flaw is that all of a sudden, AA doesn't seem like it's doing that much for you anymore, because you've already gotten everything that you really wanted. And so you begin to tire of this, and you begin to think that, you know, AA is kind of for losers. And I was a loser, but I'm not anymore, so I don't need to be here as much. And I'll come back and shower the group with my wisdom and pick up a chip every now and again. But, you know, I've got a life, right? You know? I was so glad when I got here that, like, when people said, I'm going to get back to my life now, that didn't really resonate with me, because I had no life to get back to. Like, I was living with my parents when I was 32. I was dying of cancer, dude. Like, I looked like shit. Like, I don't want to get back to that. I had successfully wrecked everything else. So I guess, I mean, there was only forward here. I think the more marginal your commitment is to AA, the more burdensome it's going to seem to you. It's odd, isn't it? The less you do it, the less you do the stuff we do here, the more of a pain in the ass it's going to be. And because, you know, I've been sober 19 years, and I pretty much do the same things that I did when I got here. I don't go to as many meetings as my first year, but I sponsor a lot more guys. You know, my life is full of AA, and I never tire of what happens here. I never get sick of coming here. I've never looked at this as an inconvenience. I've looked at certain people as an inconvenience, but I've never, like, looked at, you know, it was funny, and I'll wrap up with this. My wife and I got in a little discussion about a meeting that we both go to. In my humble and exactly right estimation, this meeting sucks. But it's the night that we all go out together, and it, you know, like the whole fellowship gets together, and we make a big thing out of it, and all this kind of stuff. And I said, "Yeah, but the meeting sucks." And she rightly pointed out that You know, a meeting, like I said at the beginning, really never sucks if you're there for the right reason. And the reason that I do this, the reason I'm here, is for the next drunk that comes in. And that doesn't make me a great guy. This is necessary to life for me. It's not out of altruism. It's out of survival. But here's the thing. When I operate that way, when I operate where my life is centered around God and other people rather than myself, I get so much more than living a self-centered life could ever give me. There's nothing that compares to what you're given when you just give over your life to God and you just trust what he has in store for you. There's nothing that compares to that. There's nothing that compares to living a life where you're free of yourself. Thank you so much, AA.